This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin, 8:36 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and joining me on the phone is my good friend Doug Finke, State House Bureau reporter from the State Journal Register of Springfield. Good morning, Doug.
How are you, Rick?
Suffering from that cold that I picked up in Springfield. A lot of people, you know, have State Fair souvenirs. Mine is a cold. And I'm happy to share it with everybody, trust me.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, Engineer Bob is staying as far away as he can from me right now here in the studio. Thanks for coming on the show. I wanted to talk about a lot of things because, you know, normally at State Fair time, other than the fair and some of the politicians at the fair, there isn't really anything going on in Springfield. But here we have the Illinois House on Wednesday is reconvening. Last Sunday, the Illinois Senate overrode the governor's rewrite of what's known as Senate Bill 1, and that's the bill that would define a new way to distribute general state aid for the public schools in this state. And we have the governor's rewrite of it. At the fairgrounds, he said that on Republican Day, Governor's Day at the fair, at the fairgrounds, he said, well, the only part I took out was the part that's the Chicago bailout. And quite frankly, the bill that he rewrote, it's more than just Chicago. The changes he made go far and wide and affect hundreds of school districts across the state. I mean, it's a complicated issue, but it's one of these things where when the governor says there's, you know, all these school districts will get more money than Senate Bill 1 provides, that's true in the first year, but it's what's in the out years. That's really kind of the key of this bill.
Exactly. Going back to the number of changes made, the original author of the bill, Senator Andy Menar from Bunker Hill, said that he made more than 100 changes to the original bill, which means it's way beyond just taking out what he says is the Chicago bailout provisions. And a number of the things that he inserted in there, in fact, do in the out years. I think 2020 is the year that a number of districts may actually see some declines in their state aid. One of the things that was changed was a provision for hold harmless. The original idea was that every school district keeps what they're getting now, and then the new money that comes in is distributed through this new formula. The governor is changing that to go from a district hold harmless to a per pupil hold harmless. And the effect of that is a school district that is losing students, and there are many in the state that are doing that, would eventually get less money under that provision. And there are many others in there, other changes of the same ilk that will eventually cost school districts. So the numbers look kind of gaudy right now, but you have to look at what happens after 3 years to see what, 3 or 4 years to see what the total impact is.
Well, and really the point of doing this, and you know, Doug, you're a veteran of covering Springfield, and I've spent more than my fair share of time there. And, you know, whenever we've had these proposals to actually change the school aid formula, one, it was always a matter of, well, some districts win and some districts lose. And this is the first time, and I think even this was true even in the Republican version, was, you know, no school district's going to be a loser. Because it was always... Go ahead.
Well, no, and you're absolutely right. I mean, this is not the first time they've tried to redo the formula. There have been a couple of previous versions, and they died for exactly the reason you said, that some school districts came out ahead, some lost money. And you couldn't sell that to the lawmakers whose school districts are going to lose money. So they finally came up with this hold harmless provision that just said, okay, nobody loses. And going forward, we distribute the money in a new method.
Well, plus, when you do, since there's so rare opportunities to actually achieve a rewrite of the school aid formula, because the current one, I think, is 25 years old or so,
at least
yeah, if not 30. But it's about the future. It's to kind of establish a, you know, this is the template for how we're going to do things in the future. So that's why I think the out years are, you know, that's kind of the real issue here.
Exactly. And, you know, there's agreement on both parties, Republicans and Democrats, that the current system is flawed. The idea is to make sure that state aid goes to the school districts with the most need. They either have a large number of low-income students who studies have shown need extra spending, or they have a low amount of property wealth, so they can't pay for school districts on their own with their property taxes. So the idea is to get the most money to those kinds of districts. The current formula just doesn't do that effectively, and that's why I think there's pretty much universal agreement that it should be changed.
So the concept, the whole concept here is of this legislation is to go to something called evidence-based funding. And it's about two dozen different factors that come into play here. But there were provisions in the bill as passed that the governor took out, such as, you know, inflationary costs adjustment. That the governor took that out. Regional cost differences. It costs different. Educational costs in Springfield are different than they are in Naperville. So there was a regionalization factor that got taken out. You mentioned the shift from district hold harmless to now it's going to be in a couple of years it would go to a per student. Over 500 districts lose money there. Then you have the governor's argument about tax increment financing districts and how he calls it a subsidy that this state aid goes to Chicago and school districts that have tax increment financing districts in them, and says, well, that's something that should be that officials should think about when they create these TIF districts. And the fact of the matter is, TIF districts are created by municipalities. They're not created by school districts. And there's only one school district in the state that's run by a municipality, and that's Chicago.
Yeah, and I think that change that he made was clearly aimed at Chicago. Everyone knows that the city has a fair amount of property value tied up in TIF districts, but Chicago is not the only city affected by that. I mean, Springfield, which is a fraction of the size of Chicago, obviously, has multiple TIF districts created. And the school district down here does not get the property wealth from those TIF districts. But at the same time, the changes that the governor makes says the school district has to pretend like it is getting that money. And then we're going to base state aid on what the school district could be getting but isn't.
Yeah, and there are hundreds of TIF districts across the state. There are over 100 in Chicago alone, and that's that issue is always constantly being debated here when it comes to school funding. But that having been said, you know, again, I go back to the governor's words at the state fairgrounds on Governor's Day, where he was trying to sell his rewrite, even though the Senate had already overridden it, but still trying to sell his rewrite and saying, all he changed was the Chicago bailout portion of the bill. There are a lot, as I said, a lot more ramifications, as Doug and I hopefully are helping explain. We're speaking with Doug Finke, State House Bureau Reporter for the State Journal Register of Springfield. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with Doug Finke, State House Bureau Reporter for the State Journal Register of Springfield. We've been talking about Senate Bill 1. That's the school funding bill. And so, Doug, we've got the House reconvening on Wednesday. Senate's already overridden the governor's changes. Speaker Madigan says he's calling the House in to consider an override. And I'm not sure how this is going to go because unlike the Senate, which could have done it with all Democratic votes, although they did get one Republican senator's vote, in the House, there are 67 Democrats, and they need at least four Republican votes. And I'm not hearing much about, you know, people potentially breaking ranks as they did with the budget and the tax package.
No, and the fact of the matter is they may need more than four Republican votes. Not every Democrat voted for this bill in the first place. So the to say that they need only four votes is assuming that every Democrat is going to be there and every Democrat is going to vote in favor of the override, which is a big assumption.
Correct.
And you're right, several of the Republicans who voted in favor of the budget, Representative Steve Anderson, for example, who is one of the leaders of the House Republicans who voted for the budget, has recently said he adamantly is not going to do it. Representative Sarah Wojcicki-Menez, who is from the Springfield area here, voted for the budget. And as of Friday, when I talked to her, she said, no, she's not going to vote for the override. So I wouldn't expect the Republican votes to be there. And if they're not there, then the Democrats can't do it by themselves.
And interesting fact, those two are also announced that they're retiring from the General Assembly. After.
Right, and the fact of the retirement, and that's one of the reasons why I asked Representative Jimenez if that had changed her opinion about the override, and she said no, the fact that she's not running again is not going to cause her to cross the governor in this case.
So the belief is that if this doesn't, if the override is not successful, that then the House will basically just repass a version of Senate Bill 1. With a simple majority, and
I don't think they can do it with a simple majority.
Well, that's true, because it would have to be an immediate effective date.
Right, so they'd still need 71 votes. There is a bill. One of the things the Senate did when they did the override is they also passed a backup bill that includes all the stuff that's in the original Senate Bill 1 without the changes the governor made. They passed that. It's sitting over in the House. And Speaker Madigan said that if the override of Senate Bill 1 fails, that he'll start moving on this backup bill. But again, that still needs 71 votes. So I think there's a lot of opinion out there that that bill could be used as a vehicle if the four leaders come up with some kind of compromise. They had a meeting in Chicago Friday that allegedly went well. So that's a word that came out of that. They're supposed to get back together again in Springfield on Tuesday, and we'll see if they can reach a compromise, because I think a whole lot of people believe that's ultimately going to be the resolution for this.
As a new piece of legislation.
Right. There would be changes to the what originally passed. I know one of the things that's gotten a lot of attention is possibly a voucher or tax credits for school vouchers to so kids can go to private or alternative schools. That could be part of the mixture. There's been some discussion about maybe some property tax relief being part of the mixture. But we'll see.
Yeah. And of course, as we talk about these meetings with the leaders of the House and Senate, Republican and Democrat, there's one person who's not in the room.
Exactly, and that's one of the, I think, the frustrations of Senator Cullerton last week made mention of the fact that sometimes you end up negotiating against yourself because the governor isn't part of the discussion, so the four leaders can reach an agreement on something, but if the governor decides he doesn't want to sign off on it, then we're back at square one again.
And that's still, we wait to see what happens there. Let's shift gears a little bit, talk about 2018 politics. We had the political days down in Springfield coinciding with the state fair. Democrats had their annual brunch. And, of course, a lot of people talk, 23 speakers, I think. But it was done in 2.5 hours, which I thought was pretty efficient. I will give them credit on that. But you had nine announced candidates for governor, not some more candidates for governor than others in that bunch.
Right.
You also had 1,800 people attending this brunch. And, I think of interest, just does that mean there's more interest in this governor's race? Does it mean it's part of the activism that's post-Trump? Or is it the fact that since they weren't going out to the fairgrounds that everybody decided to come to brunch?
Is choice number four all of the above? I think all of those factors probably played into it. Certainly the Democrats are more energized now than they were, partly because of Trump, partly because of Browner, and I think you can't discount the fact that being at the brunch is a nice, comfortable alternative to going out to the fairgrounds necessarily.
And sweating, yes.
Same speeches you heard in the morning.
Right, right, and the Republicans don't really have a traditional brunch. They have a Republican State Central Committee meeting, they have a county chairman's meeting, and then they go out to the fairgrounds and they do their event. I was kind of surprised. Given previous years of more recent vintage, I kind of expected that there would have been some union protesters, for example, out at Republican Day, out at the fairgrounds, and there weren't any. There were some people protesting House Bill 40, which is the legislation that would expand abortion coverage under Medicaid and also to state workers' health insurance. But there weren't, some of those loud chants. And in fact, it's not just, unions chanting at Republicans or whatever. I mean, remember Pat Quinn got shouted down by the unions in a memorable fashion one year. I kind of expected the activism would have shown itself, particularly over at the fair on Republican Day.
And I wonder if there was any connection between that and the fact that the Republican Party, a week before Governor's Day, sent out an email saying that I think Speaker Madigan's forces are going to disrupt the fair this year, so it's important for all Republicans to show up and enforce and make a statement. So in light of that, I wonder if maybe there was some belief that
denying them that opportunity kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but, it was kind of interesting because of having heard, like for the Democratic brunch, I've pretty much heard the stump speeches of the candidates, of all of them. Dan Biss, for example, state senator from Evanston, do we want an election or an auction? That's one of his stock lines, heard many times. I thought it was interesting, though, that Chris Kennedy devoted his entire pitch, as you will, to Charlottesville.
Yes, and there were others, of course, who...
there were a lot of references to it, but his entire pitch was devoted to Charlottesville.
I don't know exactly how to explain it.
I kind of took it as, one, he made reference to, of course, his slain father, Robert F. Kennedy, and to his uncle, President John F. Kennedy, and the fact that, Arlington National Cemetery was the homestead of Robert E. Lee. It was kind of interesting when I came out, a Kennedy supporter was talking with a group of them, and they said that was very much a Kennedy-esque speech. And I think...
It probably was, and... He's certainly going to capitalize on his name in this primary election, and so probably didn't do him any harm. Although I did see some references that people thought it was maybe somewhat lackluster compared to some of the other speeches. But
there was no mention, of the issues going on in Illinois and or even who the Republican opponent Bruce Rauner would be. That's kind of what I thought was just kind of strange about that was, because you do have this fact, and Doug House, who's the head of the Democratic County Chairman's Association, has tried to make the point repeatedly, let's focus on the main issue, and that's the Democrats' effort to defeat Bruce Rauner, not for Democrats to attack each other, which really, that didn't happen except for occasional references, like I said, to Dan Biss talking about, billionaires and that kind of thing.
And there was Alderman Pilar, who made the kind of a direct connection between Charlottesville and the governor. In his speech, he talked about how
the education bill,
veto the Senate Bill 1, was pitting poor white children against poor black and brown children, and that those sort of things lead directly to incidents like we have in Charlottesville.
Right. It's Charlottesville being at the far end of the spectrum, but it's things, in his view, like Senate Bill 1 that are at the start of that spectrum.
Exactly. So, exactly.
Well, Doug Finke, my friend and colleague from the State Journal Register of Springfield, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Sure. Glad to be here.
We'll be back with more right after this.